I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. What would happen if every anchor institution in your city, your universities, libraries, parks, museums, major sports facilities, were in perfect alignment around a few big goals, contributing their maximum to your city's success and to their own? Our guests today are leading anchor institutions with imagination and energy, and they are key participants in an upcoming discussion to take place May 1st and 2nd in San Jose on the topic of leveraging anchor institutions for urban success. Paul Holdengraber is the Director of Public Programs and live from NYPL at the New York Public Library. Josephine Ramirez is Vice President of Programming and Planning at the Music Center in Los Angeles. They are both transforming the role of anchor institutions in their communities, and we'll talk to them today in Smart City right after this news. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Paul Holdengraber is the Director of Public Programs and live from NYPL at the New York Public Library. A recent W Magazine profile describes him as an exuberant 46-year-old with an unplaceable accent and the ability to quote Thomas Jefferson and Leonard Cohen in a single sentence. When you were being recruited to your current job, Paul, the president of the New York Public Library said he wanted you to oxygenate the library. What was it he really wanted you to do?
Well, he flew out to Los Angeles to recruit me, which was kind of a bold gesture. And over some meal, after having seen the beautiful Pacific Ocean, which may have served as inspiration, he did say to me, "Paul, I want you to come to New York City." I had no intention at that moment of doing something like that. I was very happy on the coast where you're calling from. And he said, "I want you to oxygenate the library," which I thought was a most extraordinary comment. Basically, he meant give it some life, I imagine, that it much needed. Give it some vitality, even more vitality than it already has. And I have transformed his comment of oxygenate the library, though I use it on occasion, to say that my goal is really to make the lions roar.
And how do you make the lions roar?
I make the lions roar by bringing unexpected encounters into the library, by triggering people's imagination, by bringing people from all walks of life to entertain people with matters of thought, pleasure, and all kinds of different subjects that I know people want to hear spoken about.
And you do that by staging conversations or salons at the library. You call them live.
I never love the word salon because it always makes me think that I'm just about to go to the hairdresser. But what I try to stage here is something I call cognitive theater. And so instead of having people come here and give lectures, which is something that I think very rarely works, I put them in conversation, often goad them with a good moderator, though I prefer the word instigator, and have them converse about a variety of subjects. And I do it in a way that I hope is more lively than the usual conversation, the usual lecture you hear, particularly in the academic world.
What is the key to a good conversation, to staging a good conversation?
Well, it's a little bit like what St. Augustine said about time. You know it when you see it, you know it when you feel it, you know it when the passage of time happens. When you're around a dinner table, perhaps in your home or with friends, and a good conversation is about to take place or is taking place, you know it's happening. There are a variety of reasons that conversations work and don't work. They work when people share adjectives. They work when people are in disagreement and yet respectful. It works when the issues are important and they need to be spoken about. It works when you go from one place to the next and are led by someone who is skillful but also lets you digress. So digression is also part of what makes a conversation great. And, you know, digression in a sense is the sunshine of narrative.
And what stands in the way of good conversation?
Pedantry, I would say, is one aspect of matters that really stands in the way. I think people who take themselves too seriously, subjects are serious, people should not be. I think that what works in a conversation is exactly what makes it not work, when there isn't play. In a conversation, there should be play. It should be both rigorous and playful. A conversation that doesn't go anywhere is a conversation where some interlocutor doesn't engage or brushes aside perhaps criticism. Criticism is very important in a conversation. Criticism at the highest level, meaning that you take a critical look at what your subject is saying. And chumminess is a terrible thing on stage. There always has to be some edge, some engagement. And when there is engagement, then the life of the mind really profits from that.
What is the best conversation you've ever staged?
In the last month, I have had sheer and utter pleasure twice. A pleasure that I would compare to the greatest physical pleasure we might sometimes feel, what Nabokov called a tingle in one's spine. But I think it's actually a pleasure that comes upon us in every part of our body. I recently had the pleasure of interviewing Werner Herzog, the very great German director, perhaps one of the last poets of cinema. And we had about 1,500 people wanting to come, and about 600 got in. Much of the audience was very young because they wanted to hear this extraordinary film director speak, one of the last film directors who's totally free. And what was just miraculous was that everything Werner Herzog said was not predictable. So that, for instance, when we got on stage after I showed a 5-minute excerpt of a Fred Astaire movie, he loved Fred Astaire, which itself is quite surprising, he was able to speak about the lack of gravity and the fact that Los Angeles is the only city with substance in America, which is not the common thing one hears in New York. I also had an extraordinary time recently with a great English-Australian critic, a critic who lives in England but is Australian, named Clive James, who's very well known in the radio and television world because he's been on the BBC for 40 years. And he just completed a book that took him 40 years to do called Cultural Amnesia. And we simply connected deeply. But I've also staged things of which I was not an immediate part. We did an opera in the reading room based on the elements of style, thereby breaking every rule that you can possibly imagine. The reading room is a place of silence. It was broken through music, through operatic music in the reading room, and we probably broke even a few rules of grammar, which pleased me greatly. And John Hope Franklin, when he was interviewed by President Clinton, that was a great moment, partly because Clinton, who, as you know, has a lot to say, was actually extremely attentive. And that's another aspect that makes a great conversation great. There's an old Yiddish saying that we have two ears and one mouth. I'm respecting it very badly now. We need to listen, perhaps, more than we speak.
The New York Times seems to be following your lead, also staging live conversations and more of them. In fact, live intellectual programming is proliferating all over the city. In our media-saturated world, why, Paul, has there been an explosion of live conversations? What need is it they fill?
I would say I think this is an extremely important and very judicious question. I think in our media-saturated world, perhaps we need something that is not media-saturated. Perhaps we need genuine, real conversations. In a world where sound bites are prevalent, perhaps we need conversations that take time to happen. And that's one of the reasons I used to work sometimes for New York, National Public Radio, for KCRW out in Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I most loved about the radio is that, in fact, you had time. You sometimes had half an hour to explore a theme. And I think in our media-saturated world, things have to be said in sound bites very quickly, as fast as one possibly can. And I think people are craving, really craving conversation. It's not happening a lot anymore. And it's an art which is about to disappear if we don't salvage it. There's something else, though, which I think is equally important. People need to meet. You need to meet other people. And when you go to a live event, You are there with 500, 600, 700 people, sometimes 200 or 300, and they're listening to the same thing you're listening to. And afterwards, very often we have receptions, if we have a sponsor, and people can continue a conversation. You need something to actually talk about. So these events provide you with a subject to go up to somebody and say, hello, what did you think? Mm-hmm. I'm not saying that I'm a full-service department and that we're offering easy dating, but I would say that it is important that you actually have a safe place, and the library is one of them, where you can actually meet people and converse. I used to say in Los Angeles that the loneliest thing is a drive home after an event. So you need a place where you create kind of a public square, a place where people can interact with each other. As I often say, you can't tickle yourself. You need others.
You've said that you wanted to go beyond academic discourse and speak to a very large public and to the common reader. How do you strike that balance, Paul, between appealing to a larger audience and not losing a more sophisticated crowd?
Well, I think balance is the right word. Dance is another word. I think I said it a little bit earlier when I said I try to get away from the notion of people being spoken at. And a conversation, I think, to some extent changes the whole way in which we listen to people. An engagement with the audience that makes it very clear, particularly when I'm the instigator or the moderator or the conversant with one of the people I invite, I make sure that the audience feels a level of engagement with the conversation, so that I try to stay away from what one might call the extremely arcane, yet I also believe in the difficult. So some of the conversations I stage actually demand from the public an effort. Effort is good, but you also have to give people the key, and you have to figure out a way of not making it so esoteric that you lose people. So we also have evenings which are really modulated, where different activities happen, where we might, for instance, in a tribute to Primo Levi, we might show a bit of film, we might also have Maria Tucci, the great actress, reading a little bit of the Italian of Primo Levi, then translated into English. So people actually hear the musicality at the same time as they understand the original. So it's a way of drawing people in. I like quoting the sentence of Oscar Wilde, who said that either you make people artistic or you make art popular. And you have to find a way of creating a desire in people to learn more. The most important thing that I can do is give people the desire for learning.
You've talked about the impact of Live from NYPL on the library itself, that it's given it some life, it's made the lions roar, as you put it. What has been the impact, or what would you hope to be the impact of your program beyond the library's borders? In the city, and what the city and what it takes for the city to be a successful city?
Well, I would say this. Within the library, public programs, as I see it, is a different way of opening the door. The lions can also be forbidding, and the steps that lead up to the New York Public Library are quite daunting. And when you come into Astor Hall, which is the hall you come into right after you've gone beyond Patience and Fortitude, the name of our two lions, you feel rather small. So public programs is a way of opening the door opening the door differently to the library. And I would say that using that metaphor, that simile, it's exactly that which I'd like for the whole city to have, for us to go. A good way of putting it is Malraux once wrote a book which was mistranslated into English as a museum without walls. In a way, I would like to do the library without walls, for it to go beyond the confines of this library. I often wonder, how much does this library actually weigh? How many tons? How many pounds? Nobody has been able to tell me. The goal is to make this whole library dance, to levitate in some form or fashion. And what I'd like to do, one of my ambitions, is to make sure that the kinds of programs I do find a way of living way beyond the moment in which they happened. And one of my ambitions, not so secret as I'm about to disclose it to you, is that I'd love to continue these conversations possibly on television. As I see it, it's quite sad that there really is only one Charlie Rose in this country. Mm-hmm. I think there should be many.
What do you think, Paul, other anchor institutions, museums, performing arts centers, universities, can learn from what you've done at the New York Public Library?
I would say that man, woman naturally gravitates towards knowledge. Aristotle said it at the beginning of the Metaphysics. I believe he was right back then. I think it's right today. I think that the dumbing down, as people often talk about it, of culture is only so if you keep repeating that phrase again and again and again. If you give people something that they can chew on, they will. I think people are not only people don't only want to be fed, but actually want to be nourished. And I think the most important thing we can give them is good nourishment. Themes that are important, more than relevant, are urgent. Writers that they want to read and that they also want to hear. As I used to say when I worked at the Los Angeles County Museum of Art in Los Angeles, you know, you have to make the museum not just a mausoleum, not just a resting home for old masters, but you have to bring the paintings on the walls alive. You have to bring the books on the stacks of 15 or 20 million books we have here on 7 floors. You also have to bring those alive. Museums must be places that attract and that don't just make you feel as though you're incapable of action. And what I try to do is to make people listen to conversations, because I deeply believe that that little organ we call our ear, or our ears, our two ears, can actually, if you hear something important, it can actually transform your life and transform your contingency.
How do you square this idea that people want something, need something to chew on with the, it seems like, insatiable interest in pop culture and the decline of newspaper readership, the decline of ticket sales for the arts? How do you hold those two thoughts?
Well, you know, I used to say that my father was one of the only intelligent optimists I've met. And I would say that I don't drink Drano in the morning. And every morning I approach it with a kind of a feeling that things can be done, and that we needn't despair, and that every generation always talks about the good old days. My mother always said that maybe they were old, but maybe they were not that good. And in some form or fashion, I think that there are plenty of people, and I can see it. When I was telling you about Werner Herzog and having 1,500 people come here, and I would say that 300 or 400 of the 600 people who got in were in their 20s and in their 30s. So the public does exist, and it's a self-fulfilling prophecy to say that nobody's interested in anything anymore but, you know, what's happening on YouTube. Another point, though, is why not engage with the popular culture? So why not invite Stephen Johnson, which I did. He wrote a book called Everything That's Bad Is Good for You, How Popular Culture is Actually Making Us Smarter. Why not engage with him and have him speak to Jeff Tweedy and Lawrence Lessig about the whole notion of downloading? Why not do an event about Google that puts together all the people who now are fighting in court to debate the issues about the digitization of culture? So part of what I do is I bring some of the popular themes to the library. I brought Miss Manners to the library to talk about manners, and soon I'm thinking of doing something about how we write emails. The editor of the New York Times, as you know, one of the editors of the op-ed pages of the New York Times, just wrote a manual about how badly we write emails. Well, it might be an interesting event to do, to have Miss Manners and some other people in conversation about the debasement of the way we write. So you can use popular culture and in some form or fashion have people think about their own culture. I remember doing it in Los Angeles when I had David Byrne do a presentation called "I Love PowerPoint," and we had half of Silicon Valley coming thinking, "Oh my dear, David Byrne loves PowerPoint." Of course, the joke to some extent was on them, but they began to be critical about the medium that they may use without thinking about it.
If you were running the library or another major anchor institution, what impact would you want it to have on your city? What impact should it have on its city? What ambition should it have, again, beyond the institution itself?
Well, as you said earlier, libraries are having a rough run now. I think the impact of technologies, the impact of the web, the fact that people might be less inclined to move and to go to the library than to look things up online would be all considerations I would take to heart, and I would try to find a way of making the library and the cultural institution in general irresistible. And how to do it is to create a space that is hospitable. I'm particularly interested in the notion of hospitality. I mean, if I were to run a library or if I were to run a major cultural institution, which is something that I would like to do someday, I would want, from the moment you open the door, the first person who greets you, the guard who greets you, maybe even the word needs to be changed, the person who opens the door for you, from that moment on, you should feel welcomed. You should feel as though this belongs to you. This is part of your inheritance. This is what makes us human. And I think very often in cultural institutions, that gesture doesn't exist. So I would start from the lowest, from the person who, you know, is guarding either the art or people or managing the traffic in an institution. I would start from there and go all the way to the trustees and figure out a way of making it a hospitable place. I would also make it not always predictable.
Paul, thanks so much for visiting with me on Smart City.
Well, I'm delighted.
Paul Holdengraber is Director of Public Programs and live from the NYPL at the New York Public Library. You're listening to Smart City. The latest news in the world of urban planning, design, and development comes to us from PlanEdison Assistant Editor Nate Berg.
For many years, people at public hearings voicing their opposition to new plans and projects have been given the name NIMBY, for not in my backyard. Now, as the nation gives more thought to renewable energy sources, a new opposition movement has emerged. NOMB, or not on my beach, is the collective cry of many residents in Cape Cod, Massachusetts, who oppose the pending creation of a massive wind turbine farm about 5 miles off the coast. The Next American City reports that even though polls in 2006 revealed that the vast majority of the state is in favor of the project, a vocal contingent of Cape Cod residents, including Robert F. Kennedy Jr. and Senator Edward Kennedy, are taking an active and increasingly effective role in quashing the proposal, which has its final decision date early next year. Meanwhile, in San Francisco, transit riders received mixed blessings last week when the opening of the city's new light rail line caused major delays throughout the entire system. The San Francisco Chronicle reports that mechanical failures, bottlenecked streetcars, and a number of power outages affected the commutes of thousands of passengers when the municipal railway system's newest line debuted for full service last week. Some commuters ended up waiting more than 30 minutes for trains that just days earlier were arriving every 5 minutes. And as public and transit officials scramble to soothe angry commuters, they expect that it may take almost a month to iron out most of the kinks created by the new line. And local officials in Richmond, Virginia are also catching flack from some low-income residents who are being pushed out of their neighborhoods. An article in Richmond's Style Weekly outlines how a real estate rehabilitation tax abatement program has given tax breaks to thousands of people who have come in to purchase and refurbish old homes in struggling and blighted neighborhoods. The program has resulted in hundreds of millions of dollars of investment, but for the low-income residents in these neighborhoods, the program takes away more than it gives. Without the means to make improvements to their homes, these people receive no tax breaks, while their new, higher-income neighbors drive up property values and property taxes with their tax-free rehabilitations. The lower-income residents see the program as encouraging gentrification, and many housing advocates say the city should be doing more to protect them. For Planetizen, I'm Nate Berg.
Nate Berg is assistant editor for Planetizen.com. After a short break, we'll continue our conversation on leveraging anchor institutions with Josephine Ramirez at the Los Angeles Music Center. Smart City is made possible by the generous support of Memphis Urban Innovators, a collaboration of Memphis business leaders, including the Memphis Tourism Foundation, who are focused on bringing smart people, smart ideas, and smart solutions to Memphis in the new economy. You're listening to Smart City. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Josephine Ramirez is Vice President of Programming and Planning at the Music Center in Los Angeles. She also serves as Cultural Affairs Commissioner under Los Angeles Mayor Antonio Villaraigosa. Before joining the LA Music Center, Josephine was Program Officer with the Getty Grant Program, specializing in grant making and cultural arts, and a Loeb Fellow at Harvard University's Graduate School of Design. Before it opened, you advised the Miami Performing Arts Center to connect with the public, to avoid an elitist image, and get people to see the center as a public space. How have you done that at the LA Music Center?
We're working with a whole new, I should say, enhanced vision of this space. As you know, 40 to 50 years ago, this whole movement of regional performing arts centers began, and the Music Center in Los Angeles was one of the first. And back then, they were, as now I think too, they're started by city leadership, boosted by the elite class and in partnership with the government leadership, to really say, we are a city, we've arrived, you know, we have culture. and the Music Center was, you know, one of the organizations that did that and continues to do that by this gesture of saying, here's some prime downtown center of the city real estate, and we're going to take a huge swath of it and dedicate it to the notion of culture. And to us, in this enhanced idea about what that means, we went back to that underlying notion and kind of, for the moment, put away the impetus that came sort of on top of that to say, we have arrived. Because now, so many years later, you know, that's really not an issue for us anymore. Los Angeles does have world-class stuff going on here, and so we don't really have to keep saying that because, you know, we have arrived, you know what I mean? So in trying to kind of look at what we are going into the future, we kind of excavated underneath that city boosterism that's often the way that people in leadership positions establish these places, and said to ourselves, what is it about culture that's so important having in the civic heart of the city? And answering that question is really what we're engaged in and how it translates into programming and how it translates to connecting the public space to the rest of civic life.
And what is it, Josephine, that is so important about culture, that it belongs at the heart of the city?
It's the medium that kind of holds everyone together. It's the medium through which we tell our stories and understand one another. It's the way we communicate our dreams and our aspirations for living together and what our society should be like. It's a wonderful patchwork of communication that different cultures bring and communicate with one another through dancing and singing and painting and telling stories and through all different kinds of music and movement. People make meaning, and making meaning together is what really binds us together as a society. So we want to make sure that we provide, through this, you know, iconic space, a whole ecology of practices that we present and provide opportunities to participate in culture. And that assumption for us means that, yes, it is the formalized formalized professional realm where we, in the Western tradition, where we go buy a ticket. Sometimes, you know, we get dressed up and we buy a ticket and we go downtown and we see a beautiful, moving piece of performance, an opera or a symphony or a piece of theater. And it's a place where I can go and make my dance and dance myself and play my instrument and tell my story. So it's along a spectrum of activity that's all about art making and what that means in terms of making meaning in this cultural space. You know, it's going back to this whole ecology of practices. You have to do different things in order to be a public space that's about culture in the United States today. You can't just rely on the old, you know, sort of 19th century mode of passive participation.
You talk about encouraging people to make meaning through art. What kinds of programming are you doing at the LA Music Center that encourages people to do just that?
The basic way that we're doing that, the most efficient way that we're doing that, besides kind of one-off opportunities that we take up, is a whole new series of programs called Active Arts. And when I was talking about the old 19th century mode of passive participation in the arts, you know, where you go and you sit in a seat and you watch somebody else do it, this is the more active participatory way that one can engage in the arts. And one of the ways that Active Arts engages people is to bring them here for either dancing, singing, playing music, or telling stories themselves in a variety of different events. For example, every other Friday night from April through October, we have free open-air public dance parties. And every other Friday night, we feature a different kind of dance from a different culture or a different kind of social dancing. Some are very familiar and some are not. They bring people from all different backgrounds, both cultural and economic, and we have a great age span. We have, you know, kids dancing with their parents and, you know, older folks that maybe have come here to see a play and then they start dancing. So that's one way, kind of making meaning with each other in this large, moving mass of happy. You know, all of the ones are kind of this, when you talk about making meaning, it's not as direct as, you know, say our storytelling program where we have everyday people who have stories about Los Angeles come and do a workshop for two whole days with a group of artists whose specialty it is to help people tell their stories. And then we do like a little open rehearsal for their family and friends and an invited audience. We're finding all kinds of really interesting things happening, say, through the music making that we're doing through Active Arts. One of the programs is called Get Your Chops Back, and it's aimed at people like you and me, perhaps, that played an instrument in your college or high school band or orchestra and who still have an instrument and know the thrill of playing in a group but just don't get it out and play it very much. So we provide these kind of play-alongs in within this sort of hearty, happy group of people who are there to kind of make mistakes and learn all over again. And we find that people are so, once they get back into playing, they're so happy to have that opportunity again that we don't even have to set up the rehearsals for them anymore. They go off and find each other. We ask them if they want to, you know, share their emails. And then they organize outside of the music center and continue to practice. And to me, that is some really effective community building, bridging and bonding people who may not have gotten together before through music.
And for you, Josephine, trying to evaluate the effect of what you're doing at the LA Music Center, is that what you're trying to do, build social capital? Tell me how you evaluate your efforts.
You really hit on it, Carol. What we're looking at in this enhanced vision of, you know, what it means to be a civic place that's about culture. To us, it's about connecting people and enriching the sort of social fabric of our city through the opportunities for people to get together and actively participate in all of these activities in this symbolic place in the center of downtown. If you think about the kind of activity and the kind of construction that happens when people make art together, it really mirrors democratic exercise, mm-hmm. in the sense that people opt in, they engage in something together, and what they make together is something entirely new that not one of them could have done by themselves. And it's in a risk-free environment. You know, it's almost like an exercise for living in civic society, because it's about kind of being together, taking risks, building trust, and telling stories to one another.
You're listening to Smart City. Our guest is Josephine Ramirez. She is the Vice President of Programming and Planning at the Los Angeles Music Center. You mentioned earlier that you are in an iconic space. Describe that space.
We have about 4 or 5 acres of land, I believe it is. I could be wrong on that. In the middle of downtown Los Angeles, there are what people know us for are the architectural venues, the theatrical venues, the Amundsen Theater, the Mark Taper Forum, the Dorothy Chandler Pavilion, and the Walt Disney Concert Hall. The third venue, as you probably know, was added about 4 years ago. The three other buildings were built in the 60s. And that other tract of land that we had sitting over there waiting for Frank Gehry to have his vision and for the city leaders to kind of get it together and help finance that project has really, with the addition of that venue, it really added a new energy to the whole campus. And we began to look at the kind of vastness of the space beyond the indoor venues. We have a huge plaza space with a fountain in the middle of the old, what we call the old campus, you know, between the Mark Taper Forum and the Dorothy Chandler Pavilion. We have public gardens over at the Walt Disney Concert Hall. We have a lot of little kind of smaller performance spaces that we can use to bring the public to and that we can conduct workshops in. So we have a lot of real estate here that, you know, you need to have a vision for how you're going to use it to reach that mission about, you know, building social capital through culture.
You spoke of the new energy that the Walt Disney Concert Hall brought to the Music Center, and of course it was designed by Frank Gehry and that very distinctive style of his. Is that what a new iconic building brings to a museum or a performing arts center, new energy and new focus?
I definitely think it can. I also think that it's probably the exception when one building does that. I think it's probably a lot more complex and has to do with the environment in which the building comes through. In this case, it really was a leader in helping to kind of foment the what we're calling the downtown renaissance in Los Angeles right now. And it came at a time when the Los Angeles Philharmonic had the sort of financial and organizational wherewithal to weather the expansion, you know, and to move into a new space and to have enough managerial and organizational stability that they were able to kind of grow into that space in a way that really blossomed both for them as an organization, but also for their audiences. So I definitely think it can happen. I mean, it's proof over there of how a building can kind of change the face of something. I think it has to be placed in the right moment and in the right place with the right group of leadership around it.
I want to come back to a point you're making about your focus and your interest in particular in art making by amateurs. Where do you see, Josephine, the intersection of what we would call, I guess, professional art or high art or classical art with that of amateur art making? If you engage in art making, do you tend to buy tickets? Do you tend to have more interest in the kinds of things you're selling, or are you content to let them exist separately?
You know, the research on that is not definitive. The only research that kind of has a more definitive stance in terms of the relationship between people who do it for fun and people, you know, and their purchasing habits is education level and experience as a child visiting museums or going to performing arts events. In terms of direct, you know, cause and effect between a person's frequency of art making as an amateur or as a enthusiast, non-professional art maker, and their propensity to buy tickets or whatnot. And I think one of my soapboxes is that people in the arts tend to keep putting the frame on it that we should do these things, i.e. we should support opportunities for amateur non-professional art making so that those people will buy our ticket. And I strongly feel that that's an old frame we need to get rid of, because still it's self-serving the old model. You know what I'm saying? It becomes, you know, we'll do this so that they'll buy our ticket, as opposed to saying we'll do this because it's part of what art is in society, and we need to profile and validate it along a spectrum of activity like we do the professional artist. Now, most of our organizations are really invested in the professional side of things and trying to, you know, sustain them and support them. And it's a very, very tough job, as you probably know. And so we tend to kind of keep wanting to do these non-professional activities to kind of support the professional activities. And, mm-hmm. I think we have to kind of readjust how we think about those and respect them and provide opportunities for them for their own sake. And, you know, when we do active arts events here, we're thrilled if people get excited and go buy an opera ticket. You know, that's great. And we would never discourage somebody from doing it. As a matter of fact, we're always announcing, you know, this is what's happening over there. You know, we'll do raffles in the middle of public dances for free tickets to just try to keep people's understanding of where they are and in terms of, you know, that it's all art making, whether you're a professional does it or you're doing it here, and it's a good thing. But we're not doing it in order that people buy tickets. And I think it's a really important distinction.
Mm-hmm. Well, given the decline in ticket sales for the arts today, what do you think urban leaders should expect from their investments in the arts and performing arts centers?
Well, I'll do a sneaky thing and reframe your question. In terms of their investment, I'm trying to think of the transformative way of putting this, but the way that we think about these spaces is really, really important, what they're going to be used for. And the fact that ticket sales have fallen. I mean, it's not a lost cause. However, it has, the landscape has vastly changed, even over the past 20 years. And, you know, the ways that people are engaging with culture have dramatically changed, starting with, you know, the invention of television. And now at this rapid pace through the use of the Internet and the whole social networking phenomenon that we're seeing going on. And I do think that arts institutions and this investment by public leaders is something that really needs to be rethought in light of those kinds of changes. What kind of spaces do we build now if we take into account that people are probably not doing that kind of engagement in culture to the extent that they were 20 and 30 years ago? And, you know, I think our expectation doesn't have to be less, but it has to change in terms of how people are going to engage in culture and what is our responsibility as Bill gets at that meaning making and social capital building through culture, and yet in the ways that people are changing their cultural engagement.
Josephine, thanks so much for being our guest on Smart City.
My pleasure.
Josephine Ramirez is Vice President of Programming and Planning at the Music Center in Los Angeles. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. City View's commentator Walker Smith says fewer and fewer Americans have time to dream. We're always at work.
The paper route I had as a teenager was a family affair. From the day I entered junior high until the day I left for college, I delivered an afternoon route for the High Point Enterprise. Most days, I roll the papers and bike the route myself. But when I was sick or away, my mother and sister made the deliveries. My father would drive me around on Sunday mornings when the weather was particularly cold or wet. My mother even knocked on doors every now and then to help me finish my monthly collections. Nothing kept us from making those deliveries. My sister would bug me to get busy if I was late getting started, and my mother stared down more than one snarling dog that was blocking her way. Everybody pitched in because the money I earned helped the household budget. What I made on that route bought some of my clothes, paid for the gas I burned in my mother's car, and provided my spending money. Every dollar I earned was a dollar less that my dad had to make up out of his pocket. That paper route was a valuable franchise for our entire family as we fought to stay ahead of the so-called stagflation that plagued the middle class during the 1970s. Nowadays, it seems like many of us could use something like an afternoon paper route to help make ends meet. In their recent book, The Two-Income Trap, Elizabeth Warren, a law professor at Harvard, and Amelia Tiagi, a management consultant, show that today's typical two-income family of four struggles more than the typical one-income family of four 30 years ago. Over this period of time, housing costs are up 70% and health care costs are up 60%. It takes two incomes, but two incomes also mean two cars, daycare, and a higher tax bracket. Net-net, at the end of the day, there's less left over. Even though total household income has grown, the family budget doesn't go as far as it used to. As a result, debt has skyrocketed, savings have plummeted, and bankruptcies have soared. This has a direct impact on our communities. With less left over, people can't afford higher taxes and fees, which reduces the resources available to cities and towns. Yet at the same time, with more people on the brink, there is a greater need for public services. Caught in this squeeze, many states and localities now find themselves with budget deficits of historic proportions. And in yet a more vicious cycle, as community connections are eroded by these economic factors, the financial position of families is worsened even more. The reason is that strong community connections can help people do a better job of managing their budgets by validating and confirming the value of the lifestyles they can afford. Paralleling this squeeze on household budgets over the past three decades has been a broad shift in lifestyle expectations. A middle-class lifestyle used to be the prevailing view of the good life. But today, no one wants to be middle class. And this change in aspirations exacerbates the challenges of making ends meet. As Juliette Shore, another Harvard economist, has pointed out in her book, The Overspent American, with the breakdown of neighborhoods and community ties, the reference points people use for defining the good life now come from movies and TV instead. In the absence of any other meaningful points of comparison, people wind up comparing themselves to celebrities and luminaries whose extravagant lifestyles are anything but affordable. As a result, people stretch their shrinking budgets to spend more on luxuries and perks to keep up with this new set of Joneses. In these tough times, we need strong communities that can ground us with a perspective that best fits our real needs. I learned this the hard way on my second paper route. In graduate school, I took on a morning route for the Raleigh News and Observer to be able to buy the indulgences and treats that my stipend couldn't afford. Eventually, though, the long hours studying conflicted with early hours delivering papers, so I had to give up the route. The problem was that I had overspent myself, and to drop the route, I owed the newspaper more than I had saved. To the detriment of my grades, I had to hang on to that route until I could scrape together the money I needed. I learned that only trouble awaits you when you take a paper route to live beyond your means, rather than one to help you make ends meet. For City Views, this is Walker Smith.
Walker Smith is president of Yankelovich. He comes to us from Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta. Join us online at smartcityradio.com to listen to archive shows, sign up for podcasts, and register for our weekly newsletter. Smart Cities web content and audio archive are supported by CEOs for Cities, a national network of urban leaders whose next national meeting is May 1st and 2nd in San Jose to discuss turning urban amenities into urban assets. National distribution is made possible by the Hyde Family Foundations, investing in programs that generate lasting change to improve the future of Memphis, Tennessee and its citizens. For more information, visit HydeFoundations.org. Eric Rudd is our co-producer and engineer. I'm Carol Paletta.